The Senate State and Local Government Committee will come to order. It's Monday, March 10th, 2014. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 2078. A quorum is present.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, Senate File 2078 is part of a 15-bill package called the Women's Economic Security Act. And this package is really looking at issues around the economic security of women from childhood until retirement. And my bill here before you today has to do with retirement. It's called the Minnesota Secure Choice Retirement Savings Plan. And it's to make it easier for individuals, not just women, to save their own money for their own retirement. But it's included under this umbrella because we do have more women who live into their elderly years and more women who do not have savings set aside for their own retirement. We're facing a crisis of retirement insecurity in our state and country. And those of you who serve on the Pensions Commission know that we've been talking about this in pensions. Nearly 1 million Minnesota workers have no retirement savings options through their employer. And of those who do, only 6% save for retirement outside of work. As a result, 168,000 Minnesota households nearing retirement age, between age 55 and 64 at this point, have no retirement savings to speak of. And they face the prospect of living in or near poverty on nothing but Social Security or continuing to work indefinitely into their retirement years. To begin addressing this crisis, this bill will study a series of questions while establishing the infrastructure and systems needed to create a state-managed individual retirement account, or IRA, for workers who have no retirement options through their employer. The bill does not open the plan for enrollment. This will require return to the legislature next year and the passage of another bill once all of our ducks are in a row and we have answers to the questions posed within the bill. So there's a great deal of thoughtful planning that's going to go into this before enrollment begins. The purpose of creating the Minnesota Secure Choice Savings Plan are numbered in Section 2 of the bill, starting on page 3. In summary, these goals are to promote greater and more stable retirement income for as many people as possible who do not have access to an employer-sponsored retirement plan, by minimizing barriers to participation, such as inconvenience, minimum opening balances, or sufficient knowledge or confidence to select investments or manage a portfolio. Second, minimizing fees and providing for portability across employers. A lot of people, especially when they're starting out in their work career and into their later years, will change employers. And this will be a portable plan that they'll be able to take with them, like an IRA. We will do this without any state liability or guaranteed level of benefits because, as I said, this bill is simply about making it easier for individuals to save their own money for their own retirement. Back on Subdivision 1, we do this in a way as to both ensure that the plan is tax-preferred like an IRA but is not considered an employee benefit, which is regulated by ERISA, or the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, which does not apply to IRAs. The key to achieving these goals is contained in Section 3 of the bill, still on page 3. First, on line 24, the plan assets are to be invested by the professionals at the State Board of Investment who have graciously provided technical support to the drafting of the bill. These are the same professionals who manage the state's pensions investment with the advice of an investment advisory council made up largely of representatives from our state's corporate investment community. This is key because people don't feel comfortable managing their own investments. If they do, they set up an IRA, that's fine. But if they don't feel comfortable or competent, then the State Board of Investment would do the investing for them, and they get a very good rate of return on their investments. Near the top of page 4, starting in line 8, the investments are pooled, so we get economies of scale, which will minimize fees and provide access to private financial products that are cost prohibitive for individuals to access, like insurance against loss or group annuities, which can help provide for a more secure and stable stream of retirement income. Finally, Subdivision 3 provides for the plan investment and administration to be paid for by fees on the investments, as with other retirement plans, making the plan self-sustaining without general fund dollars. Subdivision 6 ensures that the state is not on the hook for the payment of any benefits, while Subdivision 5 makes clear that these are simply the individual participants' account balance when they become eligible to receive the benefit. Again, this bill is making it easier for individuals to save their own money for their own retirement. In addition to this infrastructure, the plan needs an administrative body, just as the state's pension plans have their own pension boards to handle the back office administrative functions of enrolling participants, managing requests to change contribution amounts, changes of addresses, etc. Section 5, beginning on page 5, creates this board with 9 members, including the Commissioner of Management and Budget, 4 others appointed by the governor, including those with expertise in finance and investing, an employer and employee representative, plus 2 non-legislators, each appointed by the Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader that should actually be the chair of the Senate Rules Committee. In Subdivision 6, and my staff is going to catch all these things we missed in the bill. In Subdivision 6, starting in the middle of page 6, this board is charged with establishing the systems necessary to enroll the participants, accept plan contributions, pay benefits, and set the fee structure, including the creation of materials for participants in Section 6 on page 8. This board is also charged with studying a series of questions, the first of which is actually back in Section 4 on page 5, whether there's a way for employers to voluntarily choose to make contributions to the plan on behalf of their employees without coming in conflict with ERISA. They're just studying that issue. The rest of the questions are in Section 8, starting near the bottom of page 8, including the state of retirement security in Minnesota, the overall impact of improving retirement security, specific options for structuring contributions and benefits to best achieve the goals of the plan, the cost of the program to participants and their employers, if any, and statutory changes needed to open the plan to enrollment, as well as to implement the board's recommendations. So we have a lot of unanswered questions that we need the study for, but we're not studying whether to go forward with this idea. We're just studying what's the best way to implement it so we don't have stumbles and mistakes along the road. In closing, once again, this bill is about making it easier for individuals to save their own money for their own retirement and simply sets up the infrastructure and systems necessary to create a state-managed IRA for workers who have no retirement savings options through their employer while studying a series of questions to help best structure the plan without opening the plan for enrollment. So retirement should be a three-legged stool if possible. If you're lucky enough to have a defined benefit plan, which our state employees have, and it's an option for our higher ed employees, Social Security, but we all know Social Security is unlikely to be enough to live on. Its average, I think, is around $1,000, $1,200. But the third leg is where we're focused here is personal savings. So we want to make it easier for people to save their own money for retirement and allow them to get a decent rate of return so that it is feasible for them to set up an annuity, regular payments once they retire, or whatever they choose that will help them in their retirement. I would like to, Madam Chair, hear from the testifiers who I think will, and I don't have the testifier list with me, but you do, which will probably expand on what I've talked about and might clarify some of your questions. So if we could let them, the testifiers, come up and then take questions at the end.
Thank you. I have Nari Ree and then Jim Scheibel.
Hi, my name is Nari Ree, and I'm the research manager at the National Institute on Retirement Security. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify here today. I just want to mention that the National Institute on Retirement Security, or NERS, is a nonpartisan research organization. We don't take positions on specific bills, but I'm very happy to be able to share some key research findings that can inform this policy debate. So there are two things I want to highlight today. One is the national context of this growing retirement crisis, in that most workers lack adequate retirement savings to be able to retire and maintain their standard of living, and in a lot of cases not to be able to even meet their basic expenses. And this trend is fueled in large part by deteriorating access to employer-sponsored retirement plans in the private workplace, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how that's playing out in Minnesota. So you probably heard about the three-legged stool. It goes around. And so the key thing here that I want to mention is that on the one hand, you've had this shift from defined benefit pensions in the private workplace, where most workers who had a plan in the workplace used to have a guaranteed lifetime income stream. And that's been converted into a 401k system in which, frankly, most of it is actually private savings already because employers aren't funding that to the same degree that they were funding pensions. And also workers are bearing all of the investment risk. And so what this has done is take that three-legged stool and kind of turn it into a two-legged stool with this heavy weight, increasing weight on private savings. And how have households been actually holding up? And the answer is not very well. NERS released a series of reports last year looking at the Federal Reserve Survey of Consumer Finances, looking at, beyond the financial industry statistics on $100,000 retirement account 401k balances, what are households actually doing? What are typical households actually doing? And what we found is that when you count everybody aged 25 to 64, the typical retirement account balance, including 401ks and IRAs, is $3,000. And if you're looking at near retirement age group, age 55 to 64, the typical or median retirement account balance is $12,000. So that really gives you a sense of this kind of crisis where people are heading in, relying primarily on Social Security and not having much else to rely on. So the upshot of this in terms of the impact on families and households, I'm just going to share with you a little bit later. But first, let me also say that among the people who have retirement savings, 45% don't, 55% do in the working age group. That's really tilted towards the higher income groups. So in the bottom quartile of households by income, you have one out of four who have any kind of retirement savings to speak of. And in the top income quartile, it's 9 out of 10. So those assets are really, and those accounts are really concentrated in the top half of the income distribution. I think that $12,000, $3,000 figure is, it kind of conveys the picture. But another way to look at it is what's the ratio in relation to income. So if you look at working households with at least one earner and compare their retirement savings to their annual income, given that, for instance, Fidelity says that by the time you hit age 67, which is a fairly late retirement age, you should have eight times your salary saved up. 8 out of 10 households that are working don't even have one times their salary saved up. And you get to the near retirement age group, and it's 6 out of 10 who don't have that amount. So that gives you some perspective. So in terms of the overall impact on where people are going to be when they retire, if we stay on track where we are now, according to the Employee Benefit Research Institute, 44% of Gen Xers and baby boomers will not have enough income when they retire to meet basic expenses and long-term healthcare costs in retirement. The National Retirement Risk Index from the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College projects that half of households aged 34 to 64 will not have enough income to sustain their standard of living. So they're going to be looking at downward economic mobility in retirement. An analysis by NERS that I did last year found that, again, two-thirds of working households aged 25 to 64 do not meet conservative retirement savings benchmarks set by the financial services sector. So, for instance, I'm 43. By the time I was 40, I was supposed to have twice my salary saved. By the time I hit 45, I'm supposed to have three times my salary saved. So it's just people aren't anywhere close to that for the most part. So looking at kind of one root cause of this, which is what's happened to workplace retirement savings, NERS recently released just last week a financial security scorecard that ranked the 50 states plus D.C. in terms of three key areas of potential economic pressures on future retirees. And that had to do with potential retirement income, including workplace retirement plan participation, healthcare and housing costs, and labor market conditions for older adults. I want to highlight that Minnesota did actually pretty well in the rankings, but one of the things we want to pull out in the report is that especially when it comes to things like retirement savings, no state, including Minnesota, is anywhere near where it should be. So just to highlight this, private workers' access to job-based retirement plans in the state, whether a pension or a 401k, peaked at 71% in 1998. And sponsorship rates have really declined since 2001 pretty steadily, even before the last financial crisis. And so as of 2011, only 62% of private sector workers had access to a plan. And similarly, the share of private sector workers who actually participated in a plan declined from nearly 60% in the late 1990s to 53% today. And this is a national trend. And I want to highlight that I pulled these statistics specifically for this hearing, but they're also echoed in the Schwartz Center report that you might have seen, Are Minnesota Workers Ready for Retirement? So I mentioned before that the kind of retirement plan has also shifted. So today, according to the Schwartz Center report, among workers who have a retirement plan on their current job, one out of six have a defined benefit pension. The rest have only a 401k type plan. And you know, what's actually happening nationally and in Minnesota is that we're really seeing the sunset of that defined benefit pension generation. So younger workers are about half as likely as older workers to have that. And as we know, private employers are scaling back on those plans as we speak. Just to highlight some other things about retirement coverage trends, small business employees are the least likely to have access. So businesses with fewer than 25 employees, those employees, only one out of four have access to a plan, compared to three out of four in firms with more than 500 employees. And there are some reasons for that that we can go into later. Retirement plan access is really strongly correlated with wage level. So the median earnings for workers without a plan, $28,000. For workers with a plan, $50,000 a year. And overall, you know, I mentioned some national statistics on the low account balances that we're seeing. In the scorecard, we also estimated for the states the average 401k account balance for, you know, current workers who have a plan on the job. And that amount is $38,500. And that's, again, that's the actual population of workers who have an account. And, you know, that may not seem like a lot, or it may seem like, you might be wondering, you know, how much is that compared to what they actually should have? So that population, the median age is 44, and again, median earnings of 50,000. So really, you should be looking at account balances closer to 150,000. So even in that population, people are falling short. So I just want to close kind of highlighting this idea that there is a severe national retirement savings crisis, and it really means that generations of workers are going to retire each generation poorer than the last. And it's a serious state and local budgetary issue, right, because it's not just about private economic hardship. It's really about what's going to be the impact on Medicaid and sort of various housing and assistance programs that states need to be thinking about. And given the fact that the federal government is unlikely to take action, ideally they should be the ones taking leadership, but that's not really going to happen, that I think this is a real opportunity for states to step in and figure out how to be innovative in addressing this national retirement savings crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rhee. Mr. Scheibel? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Scheibel. I speak here today as a volunteer member of the Executive Council of the Minnesota AARP. Appreciate this opportunity to speak with you today. I am here in support of Senate File 2078, the Minnesota Secure Choice Plan, authored by Senator Pappas. The plan, as you've heard, is a new model for private sector retirement plan that allows workers to set aside wages through an easily accessible, cost-efficient retirement savings vehicle. I don't want to repeat some of the statistics, but with our 650,000 members, one, many feeling the pain and being concerned, some of the numbers that just really strike them and I think speak to this crisis that we're about, I'd like to share with you. A vast retirement saving deficit estimated at more than $6.6 trillion, or about $57,000 per household. An overwhelming majority of Americans, and I know this is also true in Minnesota, 85% continue to report concern over their retirement prospects. And over half, 55%, are very concerned. Currently, one in seven seniors in Minnesota live in poverty, and over half those are women. For 20% of Minnesota seniors, Social Security makes up 90% or more of their family income. So 20% of our seniors, over 90% of their income comes from Social Security. Three of the five families headed by person 65 or older have no money in a retirement savings account. 40% of Minnesotan workers do not have access to a plan. That's over a million people. 28% of Minnesota residents 65 plus rely on Social Security for all their income. And as you heard from Senator Pappas and Dr. Ree, Social Security was really meant to be a three-legged stool, with just one-third being for Social Security. We consider this bill good news because when offered the opportunity, 7 out of 10 people do choose to participate. The Minnesota Secure Choice Plan is a convenient way to save even when people change jobs. Creating economies through the State Investment Board will keep the costs low. AARP believes that we all have a right to live with self-reliance and dignity in retirement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scheibel. Our next testifier is John.
Senator Peterson has a question.
I thought you said wait till the end.
Oh, I think
for
the witnesses.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry. Senator Peterson.
No, that's all right. Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Pappas. Just a question. I'm trying to wrap my head around what we're doing here. Mr. Scheibel, Senator Pappas, you started off by saying that this is providing sort of a new vehicle or something like that to provide for retirement security for people, which I think everybody in the room agrees is an issue. In what way is this proposal new? What sort of concepts here are new that don't already exist, by your estimation?
Mr. Scheibel.
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson,
Senator,
I think what's new here is it's a payroll deduction is the proposal. So that it would be an opt-out system. So then it'd be convenient for people. Their contribution would be held automatically, withheld from their paycheck, go into a retirement fund that would hopefully mass to be, you know, $1 billion, $2 billion, and then be able to get a very high rate of return. You know, the average for the State Board of Investment is about 8.5%. So, and then they could opt out if they didn't want to do that. They preferred to continue setting up their own IRA. And managing their account privately. What's also new is they don't have to manage it themselves. So it's operate like a traditional IRA, but they don't have to manage the money themselves. It would be managed by the State Board of Investment.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's correct me if I'm wrong. I don't believe that is. I think the only part of what is new that's being introduced then here is that this is a state-managed program, but you can have automatic withdrawals from a checking account into a managed retirement program that you don't have to manage. I mean, you can pay any number of funds that can provide those services. So is the new part of this just the fact that the state is offering it Is that the primarily the new part? Because the part about being automatically withdrawn from a checking account is not new.
Madam Chair, it's a payroll deduction, though. It's not from a checking account. And it's envisioned to be very low fee because convenient for people. Because right now, under any current systems, only 6% of potential investors are actually using, savers are actually using what we have available for us now in the private market. So we're trying to move those numbers up.
No, I think it's retirement security is important, certainly, and saving is important. So the difference is, rather than doing it through just an automatic withdrawal, which you could, of course, set up on the same exact day that your paycheck is deposited, the difference is that you're just going to go ahead and allow the state to be the person who takes the money out. Is the state going to be providing like a match, you know, like employers oftentimes provides, you know, an employer match or something like that?
I would let my expert to the left answer that.
Mr. Elliott, please introduce yourself.
I don't see that in the bill. I'm assuming it's not. But.
My name is Brian Elliott, for the record. Let me try and answer your question. So sure. The what's new in this bill is a few things. One, it is an attempt to, because what we heard from the expert from NERS was that retirement individuals who do not have the opportunity to save through their workplace do not tend to save for retirement. The number is of those who had the 6% number that the senator was referring to is that of those who have who do not have access to retirement savings through their employer, only 6% access retirement savings opportunities outside of the workplace. So we're trying to make it convenient. That's one. Two is the pooled investment at the State Board of Investment. The distinction being that when you have a pooled investment, you have the professionals at the State Board of Investment managing the investments. And when you are able to pool a large number of individuals, you also get access to private insurance products that we as individuals often have trouble accessing because of costs. Things like group annuities that might be able to pay out, in other words, be able to annuitize the funds when someone reaches retirement age at a lower cost than we as individuals can achieve. Things like insurance against loss of the assets. These sorts of insurance products that are too expensive for individuals to access as individuals, but when you get a large group of participants pooled together, you can actually start to access some of these products for a lower cost.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm just trying to get through some of these things so I don't keep thinking about them as we move through the testimony. So the state is not actually going to contribute anything, and So what exactly is the difference with this versus somebody who – does somebody have to – because somebody would still have to decide to be a part of this program, just like maybe they decide to be a part of a financial institution's automatic withdrawal from a checking account. You had mentioned opt-out. Is this something that everybody is going to have to opt out of? Or tell me the distinction between, I guess, the choice – where someone in the private marketplace would decide to enroll in a financial and get into a financial instrument of some sort versus this program.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, that's one of the questions that will be studied by the board because, you know, there are still a lot of unanswered questions and we want to be able to be very thoughtful about this and take some time to figure out exactly how the enrollment system would work. So that would be studied.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, it seems to me, though, that the bill actually is doing more than commissioning a study. I know that requiring a report is an element of it, but it's also establishing, unless I missed a delete all, I don't know, establishing an actual infrastructure for doing this aside from the study. So before we establish that infrastructure, it seemed to me that we should sort of agree on sort of the fundamentals of the merits of the proposal.
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, I am asking you to agree on the fundamentals and the merits of this. The study is more on the best way to implement it and the best way to, you know, put it into, you know, what we need to do in terms of put it into statute. But we're not saying, gee, do you think maybe we should save for retirement? You know, we're saying, no, we have a crisis, and it's very important, and we should start now. I mean, we should have started 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So we don't really have a lot of time to study the concepts. What we want to do is study the implementation process.
Okay, Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, I'll reserve the remainder of my questions and comments until the end, and I certainly do have some, but I want to allow you to get through your testifiers. But I'm pretty clear on where this is going now. Thank you.
So the next, let's move on to the next.
Okay. John Fraze and Mariah Shee would be the next two that could come up and be ready to speak. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
So, good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is John Fraze. I'm here to speak in support of this Senate File 2078. Reason being, over a 50-year working life, I've done many types of work, from assistant teacher at a great preschool in Denver to over-the-road trucking. And a lot of those jobs were predominantly low-wage jobs, like temporary seasonal work, agricultural work, canneries, restaurants. So in all of these, basically low-wage jobs. The only time I briefly had access to a retirement savings plan was in a job where, despite the fact that I could be allowed to invest in a plan for retirement, I wasn't earning credit for Social Security. They called themselves self-insured or whatever. And so I didn't think that was a choice that anyone should have to make, to just sort of basically opt out of Social Security contributions. So after the crash of 08, I was let go from a job as a semi-driver, and after exhausting all my unemployment benefits and still not able to find work, I decided I had no other choice but to take my Social Security retirement 2 years early, which cost me a severe penalty in my benefits. So since 2011, I've been able to manage to do a little truck driving about one day a week up until 2012, and now I'm doing about 3 or 4 hours at a small business, and it's really not enough. So the reason I support this idea is if I had maybe been able to conveniently, continuously contribute small amounts of savings towards my retirement throughout my working years, do it in a way that was portable across all these jobs and, easy to do, I believe maybe I would have been able to retire a little more comfortably with a little more dignity. So I'm asking you to seriously consider this 2078 so that hardworking families of today can have something a little more to look forward to than poverty-level retirement. Right now I'm living on less than $10,000 a year, and I have to access food support and Medicaid to try to make ends meet. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Frass.
Yep. Thank you.
Ms. Sheehy, please introduce yourself for the record.
Hello, my name is Mariah Sheehy. I'm 32 and I work two part-time jobs. I make about $200 a week, thereabouts. I get medical assistance, and I live at home rent-free, which is pretty much how I manage to live. I do not have retirement benefits available for either of my jobs, and I haven't in any other job I've ever had. In fact, when I've looked for work, I find very few jobs that offer benefits that jobs I'm actually qualified to take. So I think that I'm only 32, so it's not as immediately on my mind, but I know I'm going to get old and eventually I'm going to want to retire. And my partner also wants to retire. And he also has juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, so he's already experiencing symptoms of aging earlier than he otherwise would. So I want to make sure that I can take care of him.
Thank you.
Is that enough?
Yeah,
that's enough. Thank you so much. Any questions for these two? Thank you for your testimony.
Yep, thank you.
I am looking for Michael Guest. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Michael Guest. I'm a co-owner for Skylark Dry Cleaning. We're an environmentally friendly dry cleaner with pickup and delivery service around the region. I started this small business 4 years ago this spring, and as an idealistic new business owner, I was hoping to offer health care and a pension to my employees. But reality quickly set in when we did our research on the pensions that we were able to offer our employees. They're too expensive for us, and there's a blizzard of paperwork that we'd have to fill out that made it impossible to execute. So we are not able to offer health care or a pension for our employees. We started with 6 employees, and we've grown to 18 employees now. 50% of them are women, and many of them have approached me to ask me if there is a mechanism for their retirement, and I hope the Senate would consider passing this bill so we could offer a pension program for our employees.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Guest, are you saying that you would be making some sort of a contribution, a matching contribution, or some sort of a contribution to the employees then?
Mr. Guest.
What you were talking about?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, we are very open to making a contribution to their pension plan. I guess it depends on how it is set up and how it's structured. But we're very open to that.
And Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, would you say this bill does allow the employer, if they choose, to contribute to the pension plan, correct?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, that's one of the things we would have to study to see what the opportunity would be for employers to do a match and look at what the federal ERISA laws are and see.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Oh, Senator Peterson.
I just had a quick question, Mr. Guest, and appreciate you coming down to testify. You had mentioned that it was impossible for you to set up a retirement account. Could you just very briefly get into sort of what were the factors that made it impossible for you? Again, just so I'm clear.
Well, if it wasn't impossible, I'm sorry, I misspoke, but it was very cost prohibitive to offer this. You know, as a small business, we were in the red for the first couple of years, and as much as we wanted to offer health care and a pension program for our employees, it was just very difficult to do so because of the amount of paperwork and because of the cost.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next testifier is Robin Rowan and then Bill Straczynski.
7th Street, right?
Yeah. Hi. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, known as MFSI. MFSI members offer life insurance, annuities, long-term care insurance, and long-term retirement savings to Minnesotans. And we have 75,000 jobs in this state, and that includes the agents and the financial advisors that help Minnesota consumers plan for a secure retirement in every corner of the state. And they would be more than happy to help any small employer or individual who feels that they don't have access to a retirement plan. What we find sort of unusual about this bill is it is a very unusual study bill in that it has a predetermined outcome to the study, and we feel that it doesn't give adequate attention to sort of the threshold questions about whether the state-run retirement plan will work or will solve the retirement crisis. We agree with absolutely everything that was said. There is a savings crisis in this country. Minnesotans absolutely need to save more for retirement, and We think it's a great conversation to have. We think it's great that Senator Pappas is beginning this conversation, and I always personally admire her passion on this issue and her passion on other women's issues. Incenting employers is an absolutely critical part of resolving this retirement crisis, but we don't think that authorizing the states to participate in the private retirement market is the way to solve this problem, especially at great expense to Minnesota taxpayers and to small businesses. The proponents cite a lack of accessible and affordable options as a reason for the state to get involved in the retirement business. There are many reasons why employers may not offer retirement plans. Healthcare costs are one, challenging economic climate, and lack of employee interest. I mean, many of the people that aren't saving simply don't have the money to save or don't think it would be worthwhile to save given how much they need to save. But the availability of low-cost and easy-to-administer plans is simply not one of the reasons why people aren't saving. For example, employers can offer simple IRAs for as little as $15 a year per account. For individuals currently who may not have access to an employer plan, a lot of companies will waive the initial deposit or startup fee in exchange for monthly contributions to the plan. Finally, the next testifier will talk more about this. The Obama administration recently announced a program called MyRA, which is aimed at middle and low-income citizens and allow them to start up a plan for $25 and put as little as $5 a paycheck into the plan. So there are plenty of options that are already out there. And there's simply no evidence that a state-run plan can offer better or more affordable options, especially without the economies of scale that the private sector has. Private sector firms have billions of dollars in assets under management and millions of consumers. There is no guarantee that the state would have those same economies of scale. In addition, the cost, setup costs could be absolutely staggering. Government estimates in California of setting up a system that could accept payroll deductions from different employer systems were between $15 and $25 million. And then you have the issue of staff. Many of these people that are going to be investing with the state are first-time investors and will need guidance. And the state will need advisors to help them make smart decisions. Further, there's no guarantee that employee contributions would cover the upfront or ongoing administrative costs. All of this makes it even less likely that the fees charged to employees would be competitive with the private marketplace. And then the elephant in the room is ERISA, which governs all private retirement plans. The bill says that the plan must not be found to be an ERISA plan, but that doesn't change federal law. Employment lawyers and analogous Department of Labor opinions indicate that the requirements, costs, and protections under ERISA would likely apply, and the state would be a fiduciary, which means they'd be liable for losses suffered and for any misconduct or mismanagement. Participation would also likely make the small employers who are participating through payroll deduction, it would also subject them to ERISA as well, and this would greatly increase the cost and risk of offering these plans. Just to give you a sense of what are, you know, the burdens that ERISA can place are the reporting and disclosure requirements alone require an 8-page guide to just summarize those requirements. Finally, no state that has considered this issue has set up a state-run plan for private employees. California is currently conducting a $1 million study and has to determine before going forward, one, whether that plan will be self-sustaining and will not require taxpayer subsidies, two, whether it would be a ERISA plan or not, and three, whether these plans would actually receive favorable tax status from the IRS. I generally don't point to California as a model of prudence or caution, but shouldn't we at least have answers to these threshold questions before the state gets involved in the private retirement business? Minnesotans should absolutely have retirement security, and I think there are very constructive things that we can do and study. Financial literacy is a big issue. People need to learn about saving early. People need investment education. With respect to women, we need to learn more about the reasons why they may be intimidated by the system and encourage them to invest more. There's also the issue of long-term care insurance, which is a big issue for financial security for women. There's also incentives to look at to make it easier for small employers to offer retirement plans to their employees. And we would welcome a study that would embrace all of those issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Ms. Roan, would you then say that, say I'm an independent contractor and I drive a van for deliveries of something and I work two or three part-time jobs, so I really don't have an employer. Mm-hmm. Are there products on the market where I could just simply invest $15 a month that you're aware of that wouldn't run afoul of ERISA?
Well, you would be an individual, so I don't think you would have to worry. Oh, excuse me, Madam Chair, Senator Scalzi. As an individual contractor, you wouldn't necessarily have to worry about ERISA. That's for employers. Mm-hmm. But you would, my understanding is that there are products that could meet your needs. And in addition, if there were not, there's this new federal program that would meet your needs.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And so I could just simply start a plan with $15. I wouldn't have a minimum requirement. Is that what you're saying? Say I don't have any money, but I have $15. Could I start a plan with that?
Ms. Rowan?
Madam Chair, Senator Scalzi, my understanding is there are plans that there are firms that would waive an initial deposit with an ongoing commitment to contribute every month.
Thank you. Mr. Straczynski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, allow me to apologize to my good friend Senator Pappas for not talking to her before this hearing extensively about this matter. During the unsession, things seem to be happening very fast.
Very fast. I heard rumors.
But thank you. And we all understand there's a retirement crisis for a lot of individuals, and they need security. They need incentives and what have you. Yes. Senator Scalzi, I'm aware there are plans out there, a lot of plans. There's Roth IRAs, all kinds of things that are available. Mm-hmm. No-load funds, very minimal fees. But let me just share with you some information that's happening right now that may help you in your discussions here. And we have concerns with setting up a structure as well. I represent the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, Wall Street, and they're very familiar with pension plans for public and private sectors. And we're aware of the concerns, but what's happening on January 29th, President Obama announced the MIRA. My retirement account. It's my Roth, my IRA, and I think the U.S. Treasury's branded that as a Roth IRA, operated by Treasury. It's a program to be offered through employers via a Roth IRA account backed by the U.S. government, much like a savings bond, and it's portable to any other private sector retirement accounts. So it's portable. President Obama signed the executive order directing the U.S. Treasury without the need for legislation, I might add, to develop the MIRA, MIRA program, which will allow private sector workers to set up savings retirement accounts with an initial investment as low as $25 and allow for ongoing contributions of $5 or more per payday. MIRA accounts will be protected and backed by the U.S. government, meaning that no fees could be charged, and account balances will never go down. Now, I have right here, show you how fast the federal government's actually working on this program. Here's the notice to financial institutions to operate the program, to set it up. And this notice is 13 pages long, and it was issued February 27th, so it just happened. Responses are to be back into the Federal Treasury on March 31st, and they expect this plan to be online in 2014. I apologize, because you might not be aware that that's going on at the federal level, to take care and address this particular need with so many individuals who don't make a lot of money but need a pension program of some sort. There's no load, no fees, minimal contributions, and we think that's kind of the approach. And I would agree with Ms. Rowan, when we're not aware of any state that's adopted this particular approach. It's very complicated, and I'm not so sure that ERISA would ever grant a letter to any state. But that's their decision, not mine. They're very particular in what kind of plans they do approve. So we encourage you to study this a little bit further before jumping into it full tilt. But thank you for the opportunity to present some thoughts to you this afternoon.
Any questions for the – thank you.
So there is a federal option right now.
Madam Chair, I'm just curious.
Oh, Senator –
I have you speaking about something that I support. Mm-hmm. Are you both in support of what the president is trying to do? And have you expressed that support? It's just that some of the industries have been against that, so I just hear that tremendous support right now, so I'm curious about it.
Mr. Straczynski.
Madam Chair, Senator, I can say SIFMA supports the creation of the MIRA program as a tool to promote savings to these individuals. We support that program. And we think much of the other stuff is related to education. People just are not aware of all kinds of options that exist for them, including free ones. But we support it.
Ms. Rowan, did you have a...
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, I personally, my organization is just focused on the state level, but I understand that some of my members are supportive of that initiative.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. All right.
Thank you. I have one more testifier, Beth Cadoon. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, an organization of 2,300 businesses across the state of Minnesota and about 500,000 employees. We're here, and I apologize for not talking to you ahead of time as well, as opposed to Senate File 2078. We're certainly supportive of the goal of increasing savings. However, we do not believe creating a state-run retirement plan is a solution. A state-run retirement plan will add cost and potentially liability, we think, for future taxpayers as well. And there's certain ample private sector options available, and as you heard in previous testimony, many at very low cost. As was mentioned, this is more than a study, as it does set up the infrastructure. What we think is first very important to ask is to first see if the state should offer this plan and compete with the private sector to see if this type of plan will really result in increasing savings, and then also first need to determine what the cost is to the taxpayer. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Cadoon, can you tell me why it would cost taxpayers?
As was determined, at least when the California looking at this, that there's a cost, obviously, to get up and running, to offer sort of a state plan, potential advisors and things as well that you would need. And then I think then you're looking at the future liability, if ever something would happen, if the plan was not solvent, or I would think then there would be some pressure on the state to also then help out at that point.
Madam Chair.
Senator
Madam Pappas. Chair, this is not an either or. This is an all of the above. I mean, yes, people need to have financial literacy. People are more financially literate than they were 30 years ago, yet they're saving less than they did 30 years ago. But I would always say that financial literacy is a good idea. A lot of the issues that have been brought up are part of what we want to study. We want to make sure there aren't conflicts with ERISA. We want to make sure the taxpayer is protected. We want to understand what the expenses could be. I mean, the only expense in this bill will be the cost of the study. And we haven't seen the fiscal note yet, but I expect that the cost of the study and the board might be in the neighborhood of $300,000. So that would be the extent. Otherwise, if the taxpayer doesn't contribute to these accounts, then there's no cost to the taxpayer. We want to make sure the taxpayer is protected. It's not going to be a state-run retirement system. It's an independent board-run retirement system. We do want to protect the state. But what the state can do, the state could facilitate the ability of people to conveniently and with low fees, with high yield, because the money would be invested by the State Board of Investment without having to hire advisors. We already have advisors hired by the State Board of Investment that are investing our public pension funds. We're interested to see what California does, and we are going to be looking at California. Luckily, they're going to be, you know, the model. They'll test it out before we start our fund. But like I said, these are good questions that is the reason for the study. And the study is not an open-ended study on all the different options, but I think that if there are other issues, other incentives that we can provide for the private marketplace, then let's introduce a bill and let's provide some tax incentives for the private marketplace. But this is not a tax incentive bill. This is a bill to easily facilitate private savings.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think someone made reference to this earlier with sort of the unconventional manner in which this bill goes about getting to some findings about what this ultimately is going to look like. This is my fourth year here in the legislature, and I know many people have been here longer than I have, but I've never seen a bill that goes about, again, setting up sort of the underlying infrastructure of a program and then commissioning a study simultaneously to be implemented after the fact. I mean, it would seem to me that the legislature would want to know the findings of such a study prior to going about the actual implementation of the program. I mean, that's just one sort of really practical problem I see with the way that Senator Pappas, I guess I have a question. Why, if you think this is a good idea or worthwhile studying, why not just study it, get a comprehensive view of the situation, and then move forward in an informed manner in going about setting up this program if we decide that's a good idea?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, I think because of the lag time involved, that if we can do more of an implementation study, let's say we have to agree it's a good idea to help people save, that it is a responsibility. This is something that government can do. It can help facilitate the ability of people to save for themselves in a more cost-effective manner where they can get a higher rate of return, where it's convenient, and where someone else is making the investment decisions, a proven entity is making the investment decisions. If people have the ability to also have a savings account through the private sector, but remember, the penetration is still very low, and I'm not quite sure why that is if there are all these great products out there. Maybe it's just not very profitable for people to go after low-income savers because they just aren't going to save that much. So, you know, the fees are going to be too high to make it worthwhile for people to save. You know, I think the private sector has had an opportunity to do that, and more power to them, and if I can help them in any way, I will. But this is a new approach that will hopefully get many more people in the business of savings. And there's no time to be lost. But we don't want to go so fast that, you know, that we don't consider all the options and there are unintended consequences. So you're right. It's a halfway, putting the board together, putting a certain amount of infrastructure together, but not doing the final implementation until we have all the answers to all these questions.
Senator Peterson.
thank you, Madam Chair. The problem with that, Senator Pappas, is that, you know, in a traditional situation, you'd have a study, then the legislature would make a conscious decision to implement a program in the manner in which it sees fit. It's actually much worse that you're engaging in a study that has sort of open-ended consequences on this program in the midst of also implementing the program, because then you're asking the legislature to sort of just trust the outcome. And to me, that's the worst possible situation.
But, Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, we do have to come back to the legislature. No one will be enrolled until the legislature gives the go-ahead. So, you know, in terms of an infrastructure, I think the biggest part of the infrastructure is simply putting together a board. That's the biggest part of the infrastructure. You know, employers aren't going to be contacted. Forms aren't going to be sent out. You know, no money will be collected until we have the answer to all these questions and come back to the legislature for the go-ahead, right?
Senator Peterson.
Just as a follow-up, Madam Chair, even if that's true, Senator Pappas, you still have an entity that exists that will then need to be, if it's not to exist or the study doesn't bring about very good findings, will then need to be repealed in some manner via the legislative process. Whereas if you did a study in the traditional way up front, you wouldn't have to make that decision. It would just not happen in the first place. So even though there may be things that need to be implemented down the road, this entity, whatever it looks like and however it looks, will exist out there. And you'll have this board that's going to be lobbying intra-government to propagate its own existence. It's just a really bad process in my mind, outside of the merits, which I have plenty to say about that as well. That's my comment for now, Madam Chair.
Senator Thompson?
Yeah, just a question. Mr. Elliott testified earlier. Are you with a certain organization, or what organization?
Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, again, my name is Brian Elliott. I'm with the Service Employees International Union.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas,
To follow up on what Senator Peterson said, we alluded to the fact that ERISA could potentially be in conflict with this, and you mentioned that as one of the issues to be checked out in an investigation. Well, this law becomes effective the day following enactment, and I would assume that if I'm an attorney for the federal government, my assumption is that people might start moving on this law, and I try to get a declaratory judgment action against the state of Minnesota saying you can't do this, it's in violation of ERISA. Would that not at least be something we'd want to know before we pass this bill?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, the plan would be a state-managed IRA, and the ERISA does not regulate IRAs, regardless of who manages them or whether the assets are pooled or participant-directed. So our information as of right now is there is not a conflict with ERISA. I was kind of being, I didn't go into the details with Ms. Rowan, although I disagreed with her, because I think that we can always, if that still is a question in people's mind, we can continue to clarify that.
Senator Thompson.
All right. Madam Chair, thank you, and Senator Pappas. I think we'd certainly want a legal opinion on that before we pass this kind of legislation. And then secondly, you indicated that there would be no moving forward with implementation of this. Where does it say that in the statute?
Senator Pappas.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, Senator, the bill explicitly does not authorize the receipt of contributions or the making of contributions by employees into this plan. There is no authorization within this anywhere whatsoever that authorizes contributions to this plan.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Elliott, I mean, is there anywhere it says that it can't start?
Mr. Senator, the study, I believe is Section 8, the end of that section, it states that the board is required to report on what changes would be required to open this board, to open this plan to enrollment.
Okay. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, what makes you think people will use this plan, the government plan, versus the private plans that are already out there? And why compete with the private enterprise?
Senator Pappas?
I'm going to let Mr. Elliott.
Mr. Elliott.
I think I've talked about that enough.
Madam Chair, Mr. Senator. Right now, of the million people who are looked at to possibly benefit from this bill, those who don't have a retirement savings option through their employer, currently only 6% access private retirement products outside of the workplace. And those of those, two-thirds are actually more affluent, self-employed individuals. The reason for which they don't have an employer-sponsored plan is because they are their own employer.
So, Mr. Elliott, Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
If it's a government plan, you just feel like, they have to opt out. It would be something they would take on more or sign up to.
Mr. Elliott.
Chair, Mr. Senator, that is a topic of study in this bill, is how to structure the contributions to the plan so as to achieve the goals set out in Section 2.
All right. Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Senator Pappas, with all due respect, this bill, it sounds like what you're asking us to do is pass the bill, and then we'll find out what's in it. Do you know if we can keep our own retirement, if we have one? Can we keep the one we have instead of getting into this? Can you guarantee that? If the government calls it MyRA, are we going to call it MinRA or Min Retirement?
Senator Pappas.
I did want to address that issue of the federal program. Again, I don't think a lot of this is either or.
I think it's all of the above. And the MIRA program is a small step that the president can take without Congress acting. But unlike this bill, where potentially you could save as much as you wanted, and we were hoping it would be tax deductible, the account balances in MIRA can't exceed $15,000. Contributions are not tax deductible. Investment is in low-interest U.S. Treasury bonds, unlike the portfolio of the State Board of Investment, which is a much higher interest rate. So it's a baby step. It's a small step. And I certainly am glad that the federal government is looking at this issue. But it's not an either-or. You know, we need more. We need more. It's not going to be enough. As you heard Ms. Reed talk about, is that the amount people need to have for savings is a lot more. And if they start younger, because of compounding, they eventually could have a fairly decent amount saved for retirement.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on a couple issues. As I understand it, ERISA would guide, would preempt the field in these plans, regardless of whether an IRA is the investment vehicle. Can one of you explain to me how that's not the case?
Mr. Elliott.
Well, do you have a cite to the code?
I can get that to you after this committee hearing if you'd like. But the ERISA provides a safe harbor for IRAs in which they are not regulated by ERISA.
Senator Thompson?
But, Madam Chair and Mr. Elliott, that is assuming that an IRA is an individual plan, right? An IRA is typically me alone, Dave Thompson, creating a plan. So that clearly isn't administered and regulated by ERISA. This is a pooling. That's what ERISA manages. So where in the statute, in the federal code, does it say we won't manage these pooled funds if they're investing in IRAs? Where does it say that?
Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, Mr. Senator, ERISA is silent on regulation of IRAs. Again, they have a safe harbor regardless of whether or not they're pooled investment or made participant-directed investment.
Senator Thompson.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. And then a question on an unrelated topic. As you know, Senator Pappas, as we sit in the Pension Commission, the taxpayer in Minnesota is getting put on the hook for a lot of financial liability in the area of public pensions. My concern here, and I understand that there's no intent to hold the state liable, but anytime funds are being invested, and as I understand this, the State Board of Investment would be investing the funds for the individuals, certainly under federal securities regulation, there is a potential for lawsuits for failure to exercise due diligence and act commercially reasonable and all those things in investments. So in theory, the state could be held liable for mismanagement of the funds, right?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, you're a lawyer, and I think lawyers always think there's all kinds of possibilities, but I think it's highly unlikely. These are individual people. There's no guarantee for a certain amount of payment that's out of these funds. It's based on your individual account. There's no match requirement. There's no liability by the state, and that's part of the issues that we want to, well, part of being the implementation studies to make sure that we have those safeguards and those guarantees in place if and when we finally implement this law.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then I have a question for Ms. James. Are you aware of any way that the state could set this and I realize that this is, you know, you may need a little time to look at this, but any way that the state could set this up so that there weren't the usual fiduciary liabilities and responsibilities that come with investing other people's money in securities? I just don't see how that could be avoided.
Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, I'm not sure that it can, that there would be a way for the state to set it up to escape any sort of federal requirements on fiduciary obligations.
Thank you.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I appreciate the questioning, and I think that it's important to think about all of this, obviously. But this is this is just a study to get us there, right? Hopefully you will bring
a
bill.
These questions, Madam Chair.
Right. And so my hope, Senator, is that, you know, these questions obviously are important to that process. And I think it's premature to be moving forward with this type of questioning, since this is not a bill to create that entity. It's a study to it's an attempt to really actually answer these questions, because hopefully, if I understand this correctly, you're going to bring a bill in the future that will actually tell us, yeah, we're moving in that direction, and this is why, with the results of the study, or not. It could very well be that, you know, the answers to these questions are clearly, you know, demonstrate that it's not, that these liabilities and this process is something that the state cannot afford to do. Am I correct on that or not?
Madam Chair,
Senator Pappas.
Senator Torsby, that's correct.
Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Torsby, the bill says, relating to retirement, creates the Minnesota Secure Choice Retirement Savings Plan, requiring a report establishing a trust account, proposing coding for new law in Minnesota statutes. This looks like an infrastructure, and then what they'll do is they'll put an infrastructure in place, and then they'll study it. So it's going to go into place, and we're just going to see if we can put the meat on here and the meat down here and then put the fat in the middle. So it's just not a study. It's actually going into law.
Madam Chair, I think I've said
Senator Pappas.
Repeatedly, I don't know, I wish there was another word other than study that we could use, but it is saying that, yes, the state needs to be aggressive in helping people to save for retirement because the private sector has not met that need. And as I said, I'd like to help the private sector addition, but so far the private sector has not met the need when only 6% of people are taking advantage of privately invested IRAs. So what are the reasons why that's not working? And I've articulated those. Some of it is convenience. Some of it is initial deposits that you have to have. Fear of investments, financial literacy. There's a lot of problems that we can address through experts that we already have in place in an infrastructure in our state, the State Board of Investment, Minnesota Employers. But what we don't know is all these details, that very good details that you're bringing up, and very, very good questions. So we want to do due diligence. We want to make sure that we have the answers to these questions. And if some insurmountable thing like the federal government says that we can't do this, even though it's in the best interests of our citizens to be saving, if the federal government will say in the end that you can't do this, then we can't come back to you with legislation to do it. But we're, you know, California's moving ahead. We're very, very hopeful, and there's not a minute to delay because this is a very, very serious crisis, retirement, and it's going to fall on the younger generations to be supporting the aging generation, a lot of us at this table, because we didn't save enough for retirement.
Senator Pappas, are you ready to move?
Madam Chair, I'd like to request a roll call.
Roll call's been requested.
I'd move that Senate File 2078 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Pappas moves the bill. Would you proceed with the chair votes yes?
Okay. Chair votes yes.
Pappas?
Yes.
Hall?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Dahl?
Yes.
Hayden? Housley?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Scalzi?
Yes.
Thompson?
No.
Torres Ray?
Yes.
Wicklund?
Yes.
Seeing that there are 7 yeses and 5 noes, the bill is passed and is referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I'm actually saying I'm kind of disappointed that I don't have my colleagues on the Republican side supporting this defined contribution plan, which in Pensions Commission we talk about a lot, that we need to have more defined contribution plans. So please tell me, if there is something that I can do to gain your support, I'm interested in working with you.
Chris, could you just
stay there for a minute longer and take them.
Not much longer. I'm trying.
Yes, he did. Just let's see.
I heard anything David was supposed to give to me, but I'm not anywhere near my town, so I don't know if you did. All right, Senator Goodwin, Senate File 1737.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Senate File 1737 is a bill on health insurance coverage for corrections employees that work in prisons. And what we're trying to do here is make available to corrections employees who are totally and permanently disabled on the job health coverage when they can't work anymore. This is currently happening for state troopers. It's currently happening for firefighters and for police officers. And it's pretty amazing that we find that our own employees that work with highly dangerous people every day are not protected with health insurance once they get injured. This issue came about because of a couple who are here today. David Campy, who worked for the department for 30 years, was an investigator, was attacked when there was a gang fight, and he was trying to help break up the gang fight. And he fell, hit his head on the cell bars, and he got a traumatic brain injury. This happened 2 years ago. He was paying $183 a month for health insurance, and now his family is paying $1,600 a month, and he is unable to work. Now, for those who don't know much about workers' compensation and what totally and permanently disabled is, that's a very high bar. It's a very high standard in order to be designated as totally and permanently disabled. Mr. Campy is, and therefore we think that it's only fair that employees who are working with dangerous inmates every day are able to get their health insurance covered when the disability is a direct result of their dangerous work. So here today, and this issue has gotten a significant amount of media attention. And the media, as well as many other people, have been surprised that this coverage isn't already there for employees who are totally and permanently disabled as a result of their employment. I'm here to explain a little more about it is Mr. Kolodeski, and he will tell you he'll help answer questions as well.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Richard Kajewski. I'm the Public Affairs and Communications Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. The bill before you today is the result of an unfortunate situation. Many of you have seen one of the two stories, or maybe even both of the stories, on Care 11 involving an employee from the Stillwater Correctional Facility, Dave Campa. Mr. Campa was assaulted by an offender in a segregation overflow unit. He suffered a level 3 concussion and is totally and permanently disabled as the result. He has endured nearly 3 years of major medical treatment, some of which continues today. Mr. Campa suffers from traumatic brain injury. He has a steel plate in the back of his head. He suffers from seizures, migraines, TMJ, and continued disorientation. He went through nearly 2 years of constant medical appointments and evaluations before being rendered totally and permanently disabled. Currently, as Senator Goodwin said, firefighters and law enforcement officers injured in the line of duty, along with their spouses, are provided employer-paid health insurance. Employees who work in correctional institutions risk their lives every day but are not afforded that same benefit. Yet, this bill is just a small step in the right direction. It allows only some correctional employees an opportunity to receive the employer-paid portion of health insurance if an offender assaults them and leaves them totally and permanently disabled. As I said, it's only the beginning. This bill does not provide the full extent of benefits that police officers and firefighters are eligible for today. And I assure you, as someone who worked in a correctional facility, every correctional employee takes a calculated risk each and every day they enter that secured facility. However, no employee goes to work wondering if they're jeopardizing their family's livelihood and everything they have worked for all their lives. The campus live every day wondering what personal possessions they will have to sell in order to continue the health insurance they need as a result of this injury. The circumstances could leave any Department of Corrections employee in the same position as Mr. Campa, unable to provide for his family and required to pay an additional $1,600 a month in insurance. Members, I am here today to make sure nobody in the campus position at the Department of Corrections has to ever endure the sleepless nights that they have that resulted from the situation that he was put in. Mr. Campa would prefer to be able to go to work today. In fact, he can't. He can't be employed in any capacity based on the extent of his injuries. Now, you may believe, after listening to me today, that this is about one person and one unfortunate incident. It's just as much about the next person down the line. This language is restrictive. As I said, it's a start. There is an agreement from all parties involved to start here, and that includes the governor. The threshold of being totally and permanently disabled has been met by only two Department of Corrections employees in the last 15 years. Madam Chair and Senators, before I stand for questions, I'll leave you with the words that I've heard from both Mr. Campa and Mrs. Campa on separate occasions when I talked to them individually. Those words are short but powerful. They said, and I quote, "We can't let this happen to anyone else," end quote.
Madam Chair, and I know there's going to be questions about about the cost of this, and the Department of Corrections has agreed to absorb the cost on this, so there is no additional cost to the state for providing this benefit. The bill is retroactive to the 2010, but there are no other employees at this point that this would pertain to as well. So at this point, nobody else is totally and permanently disabled from 2010 till now. That would be additional costs.
Is there anyone here from the Department of Corrections?
Guess not.
Well, it looks like she's coming. All
right. Oh, wait a minute. Kathleen is here.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Lonergan from the Department of Corrections, and currently there has been a request for a fiscal note. It will be coming forward sometime, I believe the 18th of March is when it's due. There may be a cost to it. The agency believes that we can absorb the cost. This is an important piece of legislation. Mr. Campa was an important employee to our agency.
So does this bill have to go to the Finance Committee then, Senator Goodwin?
Well, I don't Madam think Chair, I would
it.
Say no one in because the department is going to absorb the cost. It'll be good to have a fiscal note so that the department knows what they're absorbing.
Right.
But I'm not sure that it would need to go to Finance.
Even though they have a fiscal note. Okay.
What is the result of?
We'll send it to the floor.
Okay.
They haven't requested it. So.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you, members. Senator Housley has also been involved in this issue because the campus are in her district, and she has done, I have to say, a very good job of working for her constituents on this issue.
Okay. Any other questions? Then Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would somebody make the motion, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were
bill.
In the committee. I forgot.
I used to be.
I'll make the motion.
Senator Housley moves that Senate file 1737 be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair and members.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Senator Bonoff, for letting me butt in here. But members, before us today, I have Senate file number 1660, And, Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to offer the Delete Everything A1 amendment.
Would someone like to offer this for Senator Brown?
I'll move it.
Senator Johnson moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill would authorize local units of government to transfer cemetery land or property to a federally recognized Indian tribe in Minnesota. And with that, I would like my testifiers to speak.
Mr. Edwards.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jamie Edwards. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. Thank you, Miigwech, for allowing me to testify before your committee today in support of Senate File 1660. Under current state law, Section 306.02, cemetery associations created by tribal governments are excluded from the list of entities that are recognized and allowed under statute to receive a transfer of cemetery lands. In turn, this limits the ability of local units of government, which want to transfer the responsibility and control of maintaining certain cemetery lands on or near Indian reservations across the state over to tribal governments. In 2002, the Grand Portage Band of Chippewa passed a bill to address this type of cemetery issue with the support of Cook County. That bill was very specific to Grand Portage, the Grand Portage Band, and a certain parcel of cemetery land in Cook County. Rather than change the law to recognize tribal cemetery associations, that law simply carved out a limited exception affecting only that parcel. In the Mille Lacs area, specifically Cathiel Township, and we have the township chairperson, Barb Welty, with us here today, we are dealing with a similar issue in which the township desires to transfer a cemetery or cemetery lands to the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, but cannot, because currently our state statute does not, again, recognize tribal cemetery associations. So after discussion with the leadership of the Mille Lacs Band and the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, it was decided that a better and more efficient approach would be to correct the problem in a way that benefits all tribes in the state so that we don't have to come back to the committee and in this piecemeal fashion, and that's why the senator offered the delete all amendment. I believe the committee staff have resolutions from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, a copy of that resolution that was adopted several months ago. And so, to summarize, in the spirit of good government to government relations, Senate File 1660 in the amended form allows for the recognition and inclusion of cemetery associations created under tribal law by adding them to a list of entities which can receive a transfer of cemetery land. It is important to know that this bill creates no mandates, and these types of land transfer issues are always voluntary. And again, thank you for your time and consideration of this issue.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Edwards? Then Ms. Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm having throat trouble right now, so but I'm not the chair. I am only the clerk of Cathiel Township and have been for a very long time. 14 years ago tomorrow, our members at our annual meeting voted to give this cemetery to the Mille Lacs Band. The reason we did that was that because of the fact that we had not buried anybody from outside of the Indian community in that cemetery for over 35 years at that time. And the band had started doing some really wonderful maintenance on their own cemetery, and they volunteered and started doing the maintenance for that for us. And so the people at this meeting decided, you know, we aren't burying anybody, and there are a lot of band members that have been and since that time have been buried there too. So why not give that to them? We were all set to do that, and then when we contacted our attorney, we found out that we were restricted by the Chapter 306 and started working with the band a very long time ago, actually that same year, trying to get
together, a cemetery association. Unfortunately, because of things the way they happen, it never really came to fruition. I've been working on it every single year trying to get this forward, so I can tell the people at their annual meeting, which, like I say, is tomorrow evening again, that this process has been completed. I altered a lot of my testimony because when the delete all came in, it was totally different. But I do support, and I know that our community would support this because, like I say, that cemetery is right north of their government center and completely surrounded by tribal land. So I do support it, and thank you for your attention.
Questions? Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And to the author, Senator Brown, thanks for bringing this forward. I'm wondering, since there is no House file for this, and I'm wondering, I don't know why there is no House file, but do you anticipate having one? Because we need to have a House file to go along with the Senate file.
Yes, I, Madam Chair and Senator Scalzi, I worked on that today, and I believe Representative Allen is going to be carrying that in the House.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Torres Ray.
I'd like to move the bill.
Senator Torres Ray moves that Senate File 1660 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Senator Brown.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think it's going to the floor. It is. Do I have to say the floor? Am I supposed to say that?
I think so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fine. I think if you just say to pass, it assumes the floor. Back to Senator Bonoff. Thank you for your patience. Senator Brown had out-of-town testifiers that needed to get on the road.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's totally fine. I'm juggling two committees, too, so it all works. So, Madam Chair, members, I have before you Senate File 2175, the acquisition of real property. Madam Chair, I do have an author's amendment. This is my first stop.
It's being passed out. While it's being passed out, do you want to just tell us a little bit about what your goals are here?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. Right now, in current statute, there is a provision in law that directs the MNSCU system. It says, before taking action, and this is with regard to acquiring purchases, the board shall consult with the chairs of the Senate Finance Committee and the House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee about the proposed action. So how this actually plays out is from time to time, I would be copied on a letter that was sent to Senator Cohn saying, we intend to purchase this property, and then we would get the background. We intend to purchase it for this amount. This is why. This is what it's worth. Well, usually, since I haven't been chair for that long, that works out pretty well. Only there came something that happened in the last several months that gave me pause. And so I began to rethink this and thinking that the statute as stands is not sufficient. So what actually happened was we got a letter from the MNSCU folks, from Laura Kang, and you have a copy of the letter in your packet, alerting us that they intended to buy 393 Bates Avenue South in St. Paul for Metro State parking. And they indicated that they had offered the owner $275,000 for that property. Now, we learned that the property itself, and as you can see in the letter that we wrote back to Ms. King, that the property itself was actually valued at, excuse me,
$125,000.
Yeah, exactly, $125,000. And previously, the previous owner had purchased it for $1 off the Ramsey County, it was listed on the Ramsey County website. So that gave us pause, and we thought, you know, that doesn't seem like the right price for that property. And when we inquired about it, you know, there was some conversation around an opportunity cost because of what it was going to provide for MNSCU. So I began having conversations around the fact that we should really have in our statutes not just the provision saying let us know, but give us the opportunity to say no. You know, we don't think that's a fair price and we don't want you to do that. And I've actually worked with the DNR on various acquisitions and am familiar with the DNR statutes. And actually the way the DNR does it is they are given a certain latitude to go 10% above the appraisal price. And then over a one-year period, if they've gotten certain properties 10% or whatever under the appraised price, then there's a certain averaging that the DNR is allowed to use in their calculation. But overall, during a 12-month period, they cannot pay more than 10% over the appraised price. And so the amendment that I have before you, because the chair of Ways and Means, Representative Carlson, approached it a little bit differently. But so the amendment that we have before you sets forward some parameters around that concept that we would tell MNSCU, and the bill as it stands says all agencies, but in the amendment that I have before you, we actually do exempt the DNR because they already do that, and Bowser, as well as MnDOT because they have their own process for doing this.
Okay, well, let's put the amendment on the bill. Senator Wicklund moves the A5 amendment, author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Do you want to engross the amendment, or
yes,
you say you are not including, as you mentioned, DOT, DNR, and the Board of...
And Bowser, yes, Bowser. Madam Chair, yes. And then we also give MNSCU a little bit of latitude, and so we've said that if a property is valued in excess of $100,000, so that they have some flexibility within their own system to do what they think is fiscally reasonable as they look at properties and purchases. And then in the bill, that sets forward a process by which an appraiser would make an oath. And it's just a process that doesn't meet with industry standards. So in the amendment, we delete those things around making an oath. I sort of pictured an appraiser putting their hand up and wondered who was going to be listening to that oath. And that seemed not straightforward. And so with counsel's help, we inserted by an appraiser who holds a state appraiser license issued by the Department of Commerce. The appraisal must be in conformity with the uniform standards of professional appraisal practice of the Appraisal Foundation. And then in addition, Madam Chair, members, we said the appraiser shall not have an interest in the property they're appraising. And then the remainder of the amendment deals with the averages around the 12-month period. So I think, Madam Chair, it is pretty straightforward. We're giving the Senate Finance Chair, so it's not the higher ed chair, but the Senate Finance Chair, who is a co-author of the bill, and the House Chair of Ways and Means, the ability to say no with regard to purchasing when it goes outside these bounds.
Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonhoff, I apologize for coming in late on your testifying, but what's the reason for exempting in line 1.2 and 1.3 those agencies?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I do have a woman from the DNR here to tell you, but they actually have that set forward in their own provisions. The DNR does have to comply with that, and I believe Bowser does as well. MnDOT does a very different, they have their own constraints with regard to purchasing around the risk of condemnation. So if they can't pay over a certain amount and they can't come to a deal, they would end up having to condemn many more properties. So I think we don't want to, in this committee jurisdiction, with, you know, we're not in MnDOT, we don't want to get into how they purchase, you know, a lot of times rights of way, and it's a much more complicated process.
Thank you.
Than straightforward purchasing. But they are here if you want to
Senator
ask
Bonhoff,
them.
Where does it say that the agencies have to consult with the finance chair, the chair of Ways and Means? Is that somewhere else in the statute, not in the bill before us?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And that I have that before me. I'm not sure if
you
do.
Is that an approval or a notification?
Madam Chair, that's a notification.
Mm-hmm.
and it would continue to be a notification if it wasn't more than 10% above the appraised value. But if they went over 10%, then it has to be an approval process?
Yes. Council, can you help me there?
I don't have it.
So it's, Madam Chair, it's 136F.60. The board may purchase property adjacent to, and then it says, before taking action, the board shall consult with the chairs of the Senate Finance Committee and the House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee about the proposed action. So that is what current law states. And that is not changing.
And I'm just having trouble with the engrossing the amendment into your legislation. So because you said that if the appraisal value of a property in excess of $100,000, if the seller wants more than 10% and the agency think that's important, then what's the process? And where is that process explained here? They pay.
Madam Chair, this sets forward that they may not pay more than
that.
They just may not.
There was a way that they could do it if they got approval.
No.
Okay. And
Chair, I think I did say that because that was the original intent, and then as the bills traveled, it was changed to they may not to comply with state law and make it the same standard as we do for DNR.
And is this Ms. Damon from DNR?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Susan Damon, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. We are in support of the amendment, and I can answer the question that was raised by Senator Anderson.
Please do.
The Minnesota DNR is subject to Minnesota Statute Section 84.0272, and that contains similar language about requiring appraisals and prohibiting, in general, purchases over 10% of the appraised value. The DNR and the Board of Water and Soil Resources also have provisions that allow us to acquire interest in land by formula, for example, rim easements and stream easements, native prairie bank easements. These are not lands that we need to appraise because we have statutory formulas. And we also, in 84.0272, the Department of Natural Resources also has a provision that allows us to make minimum value acquisitions without appraisal for a land that is valued less than $100,000. But we have been operating under the appraisal provision for many years, and it works well.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Damon? Then Mr. Byron Dodds, did you still want to testify with the amendment? The amendment excludes DOT.
Madam Chair and members, we do not need to comment because we are exempt now.
Okay. Thank you. And do you have a similar kind of policy for DOT? What do you pay above appraised value?
We don't have a specific threshold for that, but our business is significantly different than the DNR's. DNR does primarily, willing sellers, and when we build a road project, we hit homes and businesses, and we're not always in the willing seller business, so it's much more difficult.
Condemnation.
Yes, and so this would significantly, if we lost this ability to negotiate, we would have significantly higher condemnation costs.
Senator Bonoff, I'm just curious what ended up happening with Minsky and purchasing this property, and why were they offering such a high amount?
You know, Madam Chair, I never have gotten the information that has me understand why they're offering so much, but we don't. It's still unresolved. So they did not go forward with it. We asked them to hold off, mm-hmm. and so I think it's still under negotiation. They have presented a counteroffer, and we haven't heard. I assume that they did it because they thought that's what it would take to get the property. But
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, so do I have this right? If I have a piece of property and the state wants to buy it, that the state could not buy it if it's over 10% of the estimated cost of the property?
Senator Bonhoff.
Madam Chair, if you had a piece of property and it came in at a certain appraised value and the state was going to buy it, they would only be able to buy it for 10% above your appraised value.
Right, Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
But I also wouldn't have to sell it to them then either.
No,
so I could sell it to somebody else for a larger price.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonoff, I'm curious as to, I presume that these institutions actually have a process through which they've been doing this already. Has this been identified as an issue? Because one would think that there are several pieces that occur to me. One is that, even with my own house, we had to pay a lot more of the house, from the house that we bought, a lot higher than the appraised value, just because the market was there. And so there were a lot of, offers to that house, and the best offer went through. But there, for the universities, for instance, some of these properties that they want to buy are just so essential. And so the value, the market value of some of these properties could be inflated just because of the location. And my presumption is that they do this analysis quite carefully, and they obviously will, put very competitive bids. I don't know, but is this a process for us to be part of that process as well? So we already are in legislation, but now we're kind of dictating kind of the rules of the market in a way that we say no more than 10%. I don't understand that.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres Ray, I'm not sure you were in the room when I started the testimony. Were you in the room where we talked about Minsky had bid on a property paying almost double what the appraised value came in at, and we didn't have the ability to slow that down. We could recommend. And so this was to put in place a process that other of our state agencies have already used that's worked fairly well. To say that we want to guard our state's investments, those taxpayer dollars. We don't want to be paying more than market rate for properties. I could understand if there was, as the chair mentioned, maybe perhaps a way to grant an exception or a waiver, and I would be willing to work on a waiver language if you're concerned about that. But there isn't, in law, that's the way it is for the DNR and other. I would leave it the way it is.
I would imagine that I think if somebody wanted a waiver, they would have approached you.
Right.
And I would imagine it's probably helpful for negotiation purposes if the state agencies say that, well, really, we can't give you more than 10% above the market value of your property.
Exactly, Madam Chair.
That's by law. Right. So probably helps.
I'd like to be able to say that when I'm negotiating.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Housley is a realtor. I just wonder what her thoughts are on this.
Senator Housley, do you have thoughts on this?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hall. No, I think it's a good thing to have in place. And as to Senator Torres Ray's comment earlier, even though in the real estate market when you have multiple bids coming in on a home, then the appraisal is done by the bank, and the bank won't loan the money if somebody is overpaying for a house. So I think it is a good precaution to have in place.
Thank you. Madam Chair, there is somebody from Minsky here. I don't know if they're supportive of the legislation or not, if they wanted to speak. Greg is here.
Is there anyone else who'd like to comment? Please come forward.
Good afternoon. Senators, I'm Greg Ewig. I'm the Director of Capital Development for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. The property in question that we were involved with was the third of basically a residential property that we were trying to acquire to accommodate a parking ramp. It was something that we had been negotiating with the owners for a fairly long time, and ultimately, after a long negotiation, we sought to settle with the owner, and this was the end result. It's a fairly critical piece of property for us because it's, I don't know if the committee is familiar with any of the situations surrounding the parking ramp development, but we had a fair amount of consultation with the local community and the siting of the ramp and the student center that's also being built on the site. And ultimately, this is a fairly crucial piece that we needed. And we wanted to, just like in most of our instances, try to come to an agreement voluntarily with the landowner here. So that's
and
where we're
at. And not have to use eminent domain.
Right. We wanted to avoid that if at all possible.
I think what really jumps out on you is when you see the $275,000 price, but then you're going to demolish the house.
Actually, the seller
moved the house somewhere.
The seller actually would have removed the house for that for that price. So they would we'd get a clean site.
Okay, but it doesn't have to be demolished. It can be removed.
Correct. If he did not demolish the site, we would have paid $225.
You mean if he did not remove the house?
Correct.
All right. Any other questions? Anyone want to make a motion? Senator Wicklund moves that Senate File 2175, as amended, be recommended to pass. And
Madam Chair,
you're going to a policy committee or your finance committee, Senator Bonner?
Madam, this would go to the policy committee.
Goes to the policy committee. Okay. Senator Hall, before we take the motion.
If I could, Mr. Ulrich, is it?
Ulrich.
If this passes through, and the folks don't want to sell it to you for the 10% above the estimated cost, you then have no alternative but to do what?
Mr. Ulrich.
Senators, we do have authority of eminent domain. I think at this point we would likely have to build around it. There is a question out there about the amount of parking that we would lose as a result. So our negotiations with the city are ongoing about how that's going to impact our overall development of the site.
This actually would not affect, though, that current negotiations, right? Because this doesn't go into an effect until August 1st, if it passed, if it became
correct.
Law. Right. So. Okay, then. Senator Wicklund renews her motion that Senate File 2175, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Higher Education Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
She probably wants to put in her omnibus bill. Next, Senator Hayden.
I do not have.
Same class.
Got 10 minutes with your bills.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Proceed.
We have Senate File 2162, a bill relating to Hennepin County. Before we get started, Madam Chair, this is the first stop, and I have the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I needed.
Have that in our packets. Senator Hayden moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And members, this bill is meant to alleviate some of the regulatory burdens on Hennepin County. To further explain the bill, I have Mr. John Doan, Director of Housing and Community Works in Transit for Hennepin County.
Mr. Doan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Pappas and committee members. Again, I'm John Doan, Director for Housing, Community Works and Transit at Hennepin County. Before you today is a technical bill that would streamline how the county can partner with other political subdivisions on projects that create jobs and spur economic development. There is an author's amendment which clarifies that this bill does not create a new program but actually modifies an existing program. The bill with the amendment does five things. First, it allows the Hennepin County Housing and Redevelopment Authority to partner directly with other political subdivisions. Currently, the HRA needs to enter into an agreement with the county itself who then enters into an agreement with the other political subdivision. This bill would eliminate the need for a three-way agreement, thus streamlining the cumbersome process to only being a direct agreement between two entities. Secondly, it adds the watershed district to the list of political subdivisions that the county can partner with. Third, it provides clarifying language that the county can help to create jobs using this multi-jurisdictional authority for an economic development purpose. Fourth, it adds transit improvement areas as designated by the State Department of Employment and Economic Development to the eligible areas that the county can partner under this authority. And then last but not least, it eliminates confusion in Subdivision 1 by replacing must with may to clarify that the multi-jurisdictional agreement may include a number of activities but doesn't have to include all of those activities. In the theme of the uncession, this technical bill, while it may be mundane in nature, it would greatly streamline how Hennepin County can partner with others to create jobs and to spur economic development. With that, I yield for your questions.
Are there any questions? Anyone in the audience want to testify? Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, on the amendment, your A1 amendment, 1.5, it says Section 2 is amended to read. Is that inserting on top of, what line is that going in on? It doesn't say.
Madam.
Yeah, I'm confused.
It says page 1 after line 17, insert. A new Section 2.
Section, right.
1.4. Oh, line, the line above it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Senator Hayden, what does this bill accomplish?
Good. Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Hall. I'll let Mr. Doan talk a little bit more about the Community Works Program and the work that they do and their ability to streamline their process as they move forward and put together their projects. But I'll let Mr. Doan talk a little more about that.
Mr. Doan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Hall. The multi-jurisdictional statute allows Hennepin County to enter into partnership with other political subdivisions for economic development and housing purposes. For example, the county has a program that we call Community Works, which is in the title of the department that I lead. And under Community Works program, the intent is to partner in order to make long-term investments that will transform a community. For example, probably one of the better-known Community Works projects is the Midtown Greenway, which runs just a bit north of Lake Street. It was an abandoned railroad trench, and back in the 80s and 90s was an area of blight. It was an area of drug use, as well as vandalism, and there was a lot of mattresses and shopping carts that were thrown there. Through the multi-jurisdictional authority, the city partnered with public and private entities in order to redevelop that corridor into a bikeway corridor that now has seen hundreds of million dollars of redevelopment occur along that corridor. And so this authority allows us to work very streamlined with community partners, local jurisdictions, and the private sector in order to achieve those public goals.
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, so this bill, though, just does some technical changes, or what are the major changes, if there are? Are they just technical?
They're primarily technical. Madam Chair, Senator Hall, excuse my unprofessional protocol.
That's fine.
This bill does a number of technical changes. The substance, I would say, is that it does add the watershed district into the list of political subdivisions that we can partner with. In addition, it does expand it to de-designated transit improvement areas. And then otherwise, I would say that those are probably the two substantive pieces to this legislation.
I say your name for purposes of the tape to identify who's speaking.
John Doan.
No, that's fine. I'm just telling you. I'm telling you, that's why I say your name.
Thank you.
Not to make you bow down to me, but just identify for the tape.
I would definitely do that anyhow.
Any other questions? Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that we move Senate File 2162 as amended to, I guess, the floor.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Miller. Is Senator Miller here? Members, while Senator Miller is coming forward on my bill, Senate File 2078, it was supposed to be referred to the Committee on Commerce. So if Senator Wicklund wouldn't mind moving reconsideration.
Reconsideration of Senate File 2078.
Senator Wicklund moves that Senate File 2078. I make sure this is the right motion. I'm moving to have it reconsidered because we have to send to Commerce. Whereby the motion that whatever, it's being reconsidered, Senate File 2078. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Then, if Senator Wicklund doesn't mind moving that Senate File 2078 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Commerce.
So moved.
Yeah. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. So you still have the roll call vote on the record that you took, but it does need to go to the Commerce Committee. Senator Miller.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. Happy to be here today. We have Senate File 1767 in front of us, and this is a bill regarding Region 10 quality assurance. And to be honest, I'm not quite sure why we're in this committee, but we are certainly happy to be here today. So I'm going to go through it very quickly. Section 1 adds a date, July 1st, 2014, which by the State Quality Council must design a transition plan for licensed providers from Region 10 into the alternative licensing system. It also corrects the cross-reference. Section 2 members, subsection 4, lists the three regional quality councils the commissioner must establish or continue to operate by July 1st, 2014. It requires the commissioner to establish three more regional quality councils by July 1st, 2016. And finally, Section 3 is the appropriation section. It appropriates $2.021 million in fiscal year 2015 from the general fund to the Commissioner of Human Services for quality assurance initiatives for services provided to people with disabilities. Of this amount, distributes $381,000 to the State Quality Council, $1.29 million to three regional quality councils, and $350,000 to fund an annual survey of disability service recipients. And I have Mr. Larson here from ARC Minnesota who may want to add to the testimony today.
Mr. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson, the Senior Policy Director for the ARC Minnesota, but also co-chair of the State Quality Council. This legislation originally passed in 2011, and the State Quality Council was organized in 2012. And in 2013, we came out exactly a year ago with our report with recommendations on how to move forward. One of the main purposes of the State Quality Council is to oversee quality in the program, home and community-based services programs that the state funds to support individuals with disabilities in the community. We spend over $2 billion on these programs, and we're required by the federal government to provide oversight in a wide variety of ways to the program. And what the State Quality Council purpose is to oversee how those programs are being managed and to make sure that we are involving persons with disabilities both through surveys and reviews of data and also licensing reviews so that they have a voice in how the services are provided. The Olmsted Plan, which was just released here in the past few months, also calls for oversight and review of our home and community-based waiver programs, and this effort helps fulfill part of what the Olmsted Plan calls for. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll take any questions or provide any other further background on this particular bill.
Are there any questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the Quality Council have, or State Quality Council, have anything tied with county jurisdiction throughout the state?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, eventually it would, and that's part of the planning the regional quality councils is to more clearly define the role of counties in the future. But the regional councils would play a role in which they would review vulnerable adult reports, they'd review other data collected by the state, as well as surveys of individuals in those particular counties, identify where there's issues, work to systematically address those issues, so that we get the whole community involved in trying to improve in our programs and provide oversight to them.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Larson, the state now is in regional quality councils right now, and they have counties that are assigned to each of those regions. Is the money that you're being allocated here then will go to each of the counties based on what?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, you described exactly where we want to go. We're not, the regional councils haven't been formed up to this point in time, except in southeast Minnesota where they have the Region 10 Quality Commission, which would evolve into a regional council if this funding were passed during this legislative session. So our goal is to put together these regional councils so that they can perform the tasks that I just described.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if the money does get appropriate, will it then sit in the state's quality council fund until the regional councils have been decided and the mechanics have been worked out as to how it will be distributed?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, that's correct.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Mr. Larson, then to this point, no money has been appropriated. That's the reason for this bill, because I was wondering if it passed in 2011, why have there been no appropriations, for instance, in 2013?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, Senator Scalzi, there was an initial appropriation to pay for the planning work that the State Quality Council did in our last biennium, but the State Quality Council was not funded during the 2013 legislative session.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And what was the reason that it wasn't funded? Was it a budget cut, or was there some other reason?
Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, Senator Scalzi, I'm just going to have to speculate on that, but our report and work was not included, or maybe it wasn't done on time for the governor's budget as it came out, so we weren't included in the governor's budget. We made some attempts to get put back in there, but we're not successful. But we do work with a lot of other funded quality activities and trying to coordinate those, so we think this is a key piece that we hope will get funded this year or in future years.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, that's why we're here this year with the bill, because we did not get funded last year.
Any other questions? Anyone else want to testify? Anyone want to make a motion?
I will.
Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 1767 was not amended. Be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. Any other discussion? All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members.
Senator Miller. One more bill. Senator Hoffman.
Ready to go home.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, you're moving. That's good.
Okay. Okay. Members, this bill has been approved by the Health and Human Services Committee. So we are here just to look at the advisory council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 133. The proposed bill is a licensed laboratory professionals in Minnesota. It is my request, Madam Chair, that Senate File 133 be passed out of this committee and referred to judiciary. And there should be, I think, an A7 amendment.
Yep, we have it.
Thank you.
And that is the purpose of this amendment is to put it in the shape for our guidelines.
That is correct, Madam Chair. And Ms. James is available to answer any of the questions, or actually can walk us through the simple changes in that if she would.
Hey, Ms. James.
Madam Chair and members, the amendment on lines 1.3. 2 through 1.4 establishes a chair for the council who's elected from the members who will serve a two-year term. Lines 1.5 through 1.6 set a sunset date of January 1, 2022 for the council. Lines 1.8 through 1.9 are in the uncoded section at the back of the bill, and they put the full title of the council into the section that that deals with them in the uncoded section, which is on page 19 of the bill. And then lines 1.10 through 1.15 sets up the initial appointments. The council is set up so that its terms are as set forth in 15.059, which provides for staggered terms. But whenever we set one of these up with those staggered terms, you have to kind of get it going to make it fit, make the initial appointments fit with then the way 15.059 provides for the terms to continue.
So do we want to take the amendment, or would people like to hear just a little bit about the bill and the council before we take the amendment? Okay. Senator Hoffman, why don't you just tell us kind of a little bit about the goals of the bill briefly, and then the advisory committee is what we're really looking at.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with me at the table is Kathy Hansen. She's the co-chair of the Laboratory License Coalition, which consists of 9 laboratory professional associations. In the interest of this committee's time, Ms. Hansen is not testifying but is available for questions. It is my understanding the jurisdictional interests of the state and local government are the sections related to the advisory council to the Commissioner of Health, and I will just address those in the next 50 minutes. Okay. So the purpose of this bill is to protect the patient's safety, and one of the ways it protects patient safety is provide a mechanism to remove the incompetent practitioners from the laboratory. No such mechanism exists currently in Minnesota, as it does for nurses, pharmacists, and nearly every other healthcare professional. The license bill for medical laboratory science professional will be administered by the Minnesota Department of Health, which already administers a number of other licensure programs for other allied health professions. A licensure category is defined for the associate degree level medical laboratory technician. It allows exactly the same scope of practice for these individuals that currently exists under the CLIA and does not limit the types of testing performed by this category. It does not prohibit techs from two-year degrees from continuing to perform their current duties. Language is also included to allow veterans to hold a license commensurate with their military training and with the associate degree required by CLIA for high complexity testing. Each employer must decide which employees are appropriate for the particular laboratory and patient population. They may employ any combination of two-year and four-year degree individuals. However, the bill does not lump these levels into one classification. The major national certification agencies also make this distinction. There is a grandfathering provision under which anyone currently practicing will be awarded a license even if they do not meet the education or certification requirements. In a sense, no one will lose their job, Madam Chair. The committee's elements are found in Section 6 of the bill and describe the advisory council to the Commissioner of Health, and the duties are as included. Provide the distribution of information to the medical laboratory professional community regarding the standards set forth in the bill. Members of the coalition that prepared the bill represent several laboratory professional associations and have lists of email and mail addresses that will be useful in this effort. Advising and making recommendations to the commissioner regarding the standards set forth in this bill. Number 3, as requested, review applications and make recommendations to the commissioner on granting or denying the license. In the early months of the program, the advisory board may need to provide more input than later when the process has become more routine. The advisory board can be helpful in the design on paper online forms to be used for licensure applications. Advise the commissioner on enforcement, complaint, investigation hearings, and disciplinary action. Except possibly for the last item, is it anticipated that much of the work of the advisory board could be done by conference call or an electronic meeting format. The 9 members will be such. Advisory board are represented on the laboratory community. They include 6 members, must be laboratory science professionals who are licensed under this chapter and include 1 non-physician laboratory director, 1 medical laboratory scientist, 1 medical laboratory technician, 1 specialist in cytogenics, histocompatibility, and molecular biology. It's hard to get the M word out. 1 cytotechnologist, and then the histotechnician or a histechnologist, and then 2 pathologists, 1 with board certification in clinical pathology, and then 1 public member. The structure was arrived at after examining boards that are in place in other states that license laboratory professionals. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Ms. Hansen and I will be happy to answer any questions.
We just discovered that we are looking at the bills introduced and not the first engrossment, so we should keep talking about it for a few minutes, but we're getting copies of the first engrossment made. The summary is to the first engrossment.
Oh.
So, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, I guess my initial question is, will this, by passing this, will it increase medical costs?
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, the answer I don't think is no on that, but I want to have Ms. Hansen go a little deeper in the weeds for you.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, there has been some misinformation out there suggesting that costs for hospitals or employers would increase because they would have to replace two-year graduates with four-year graduates. And there's nothing in the bill and nothing intended in the bill that that would be the case. And Senator Hoffman specified that in his testimony. The licensure program itself is designed to be self-supporting. The fees for the license and for renewal would pay the administrative costs of the program.
Senator Hall.
Is there any opposition then?
I do have Ms. Krinke from the Hospital Association that would like to testify, unless there are more questions for these witnesses. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 21, it talks about the advisory council, and I'm guessing that because this is introduced on January 28th, 2013, the first engrossment would have corrected the dates that are on the bottom there, where it has September 1st of 2013 and October 1st of 2013. Am I correct in saying that? That the first engrossment will have
And Madam Chair, Senator Anderson,
did you correct that in the last
That is correct. Yes, it's been corrected.
And Madam Chair, so when the first engrossment comes to us, I take it that the money that you're asking for, the appropriation on the last page, that money there is going to be used then to help in reimbursing costs incurred by the advisory committee. Am I correct in stating that?
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, the answer to that is that yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Ms. Krinke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. We had a robust and lengthy discussion on this bill in the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, and we stated our opposition to the bill at that time and went through our concerns regarding both cost and quality. So I'd like to just keep my comments today to the jurisdiction of this committee. Just two quick points that I'd like to make. The first one is regarding the makeup of the advisory committee, and as Senator Hoffman noted, there is contention between the four-year and the two-year degrees and what are the tasks and procedures that the four-year folks can do that maybe the 2 years can't, et cetera. So as this advisory committee moves forward, we would like there to be at least a recognition of an equal number of two-year degreed personnel and four-year degreed personnel should this bill move forward. So all the different subspecialties that are listed add to the confusion and complexity of the bill. So if this bill moves forward, we would rather there be specific advisory committee that said three members that were the four-year degreed people, three members that were the two-year degree people. I just would like to point out we did a survey of our 79 critical access hospitals. These are hospitals that have less than 25 beds, and 71% of their employees are the two-year degreed people. The only other comment that I would like to make is that we do still have 33 public hospitals that are either owned and operated by the city or county that they reside in. And so this would have some impact to our county and city-owned hospitals, most of which are in rural Minnesota. So thank you very much for this opportunity today.
And Senator Hoffman, since we don't have the first engrossment yet, did you make any changes in Section 6 in the advisory council in the previous committee?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, we did not. But, okay. Madam Chair, the issue pertaining to 2 and 4 year degrees are being dealt with and is the bigger picture. But I'm fine with 3 and 3. We can make that change in there. So,
I don't think in the language there doesn't seem to be. I can't tell which ones are 2 year and which ones are 4 year. Did you just say that you were willing to do that? But I'm not sure how you do that.
Well, yes, Madam Chair, members of the board, there's two distinctions. One is the medical lab technician and the medical lab MLS, and that one is the 2 and 1 is the 4 year distinction. But for the purpose of this advisory council, I'd be willing to do the 3 and 3 as so suggested by Ms. Krinke.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator Hoffman, are you talking about on page 9, lines 21 and 22?
Yeah, Madam Chair, page 9, you're looking at section 6. We can easily combine lines 4 and 5, which would cover up you get two medical, hash out 3, it's two medical laboratory technicians, and just combine those, and it would clarify the language that Ms. Krinke has a concern about.
Madam Chair, I think
Johnson?
Maybe it's the engrossed copy that you're looking at.
The language is the same, though, mm-hmm. in the engrossed copy.
I don't
but,
know.
I'm not sure what the amendment is.
I don't either.
We don't know what the amendment is. Does Ms. Krinke want to help us with the amendment, or do you want to be more specific? You have to say line 1, delete and add something, or line 23.
That would be in, Madam Chair, would
Johnson.
That be in the original bill then?
Well, no, we can't move it officially until we get the engrossment, which is coming, mm-hmm. I hope, but we can at least be prepared to do it. This is Ms. Hansen.
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Hansen. Looking at page 9, and it would be the same language that's going to be in the engrossment as is in the original. What we would do is you would go to line 9.22, okay. cross out 3, take the 1 and make that 2 medical laboratory technicians. 3 still stays.
Don't worry about the numbering right now. The numbering the staff can change. So 9.22,
yep.
delete 1.
Yes.
And insert 2.
2.
Correct.
Okay.
And then when you go to 9.23 and 9.24, you would combine those.
So what do you want to – do you want to just delete line 9.24?
Madam Chair, no. What we would do is we would add that up to as an or. You know, add that into the one specialist in.
One specialist in,
yeah.
in or.
In or, yep.
So it's still only going to be one person.
Right.
Okay. And that's it?
That is correct, Madam Chair. That is okay. That's enough.
So the medical lab technician are going to be the 2 year people.
Yes, that's correct, Madam Chair.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Number 5 then on 2.4 goes away. The number 5 goes and just gets incorporated into number as number 4.
Yeah, right. That's correct.
That is correct, Madam Chair. That is correct.
Do you want to
Senator
change all
Anderson.
The numbers and everything too?
Yep.
Okay. So all you're really doing is deleting 5 on 9.24. Deleting 6 on 9.25 and inserting 5. Is that correct?
Right.
Yep.
Now they're passing it out? Oh, yeah. Good. Okay, so we have the engrossed version is being passed out. So then I think that if the line and numbers are the same, yeah. Ms. James said she did the A7 amendment to the first engrossment. So, somebody want to offer the A7 amendment? Senator Dahl moves the A7 amendment. It was already explained by Ms. James. Are there any questions on the A7 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Now we have the oral amendment. So, if we go to page, it's the same page. Page 9.
Yep.
Ms. James, why don't you read the changed amendment?
Madam Chair and members, if I understand correctly, I think the amendment is on line 9.22, delete the word one and insert two. On line 9.23, after biology, insert or cytotechnologist. And also on 9.23, after the semicolon, insert and. And then on line 9.24, or delete line 9.24. And on line 9.25, delete 6 and insert 5.
Okay. Does everyone have that?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody want to move it?
So move.
Senator Johnson moves the amendment as stated by Ms. James. All those in, oops, one more.
On line 9.23, delete the or.
Okay.
You sure you don't have or there?
Well, we have
super store
there.
Oh, okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Any other questions, comments, testimony? I'm sorry, what? Yeah, who moved that last amendment? Senator Johnson. Okay. Then we have Senate file number 133. Do we have to say first and Grossman?
First and Grossman.
Okay.
As amended.
Well, Senate file number 133
as amended.
As amended. Anyone want to move the bill? Senator Eaton? Move Senate file 133 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, all members. I think that's all the business that we have today, and we're almost on time. The meeting is adjourned.